Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
All right, so it's after one, huh?
Let's go.
All right, let's talk about monsters.
All right, to begin talking about monsters, I will have people to my left and right introduce themselves.
Okay, we're gonna fight each other for who goes second.
Roll initiative.
I win. So I'm Amanda Hammond-Koontz. I am development coordinator at Paizo, and I've been working on monsters for 5 or 6 years at this point.
I'm Adam Daigle. I'm managing developer, and I've written and developed hundreds of monsters.
Yeah, so, seems right.
Yeah.
And, oh, yep. I'm James Jacobs. I'm the creative director of Pathfinder, and been obsessed with monsters for decades.
Oh, mic drop.
Yeah. Anyway, so the latest monster book we've done is Bestiary 6, of course, which is available in the PaizoCon store, so you can totally check it out. One of the things that I was excited about when I found out that I was the one that got to be in charge of Bestiary 6. This is the first time I've been in charge of an actual Bestiary pretty much entirely. I've worked on Bestiaries 1, 2, 3, and 4. I wasn't really part of 5. So I was excited to basically kind of, I guess, buck the tradition and the trend and the perception that monster books for role-playing games run out of ideas. And I've never thought that was the case. I think that it's kind of arrogant to assume that a game designer will only have 5 good monster ideas for 5 books or whatever, where people have been making monsters up to scare themselves around campfires since we've been talking. And so there's thousands and thousands of years of monster tradition we can draw upon. And so I was eager to basically build a monster book that... One of the things Eric Mona challenged me with is like, make sure there's a monster in there that when I look at it, I say, why has it taken 6 books to get this monster to print? why wasn't this in Bestiary 1? And I think we managed to do that with a couple of them. Like the Wild Hunt is something that has been a big part of games all over the place, and it took until Bestiary 6 to get really a good set of Wild Hunt creatures into the game. At the same point, I wanted this to be a book that had a lot of really high-end, high-CR, powerful monsters in it. Not just like demigods like the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, but just other big monsters that you can use in high-adventure, high-level games for 2 reasons. One, those monsters are the most complicated to create and design and manage, and having more of them to choose from makes it easier to run your games. But also, it makes us easier for us to create adventures, because when we're doing, we do 4 high-level adventures every year as part of the adventure path. And having to fill up a page of a stat block of like something we had to make up on the spot, it's always better to be able to have something, a small little stat block that you can reference into one of the bestiaries. And that gives us more room to have encounters and adventure content and such. So yeah, that's basically the genesis for Bestiary 6, and I think maybe have you guys talk about what kind of monsters inspires you, and then we'll kind of turn this over for a question and answer thing for a bit and see where we go from there.
All right, sounds good.
Sure, go ahead, your turn.
So one of the monsters I like have changed over the time that I've been doing more of them. I've always been a fan of folklore monsters, and I love just like interpreting different monsters from our own stories as humans into stats. So it's something I've always enjoyed. But as I've done more and more and more of that, I also really enjoy creating monsters that their whole shtick is a rules thing. Like just one, you know, like I want something that can do this one thing and then build out its society and everything from that one rules element. It's a fun new challenge I've liked.
Yeah. So I tend to approach monster creation conceptually a lot of times, just because of what the book needs or what the adventure needs or what the assignment is. A lot of times, as a freelancer, they'll say something very specific, like we want an evil outsider that it has 14 hit dice and can, you know, breathe fire out of its nose or something. I mean, there's something very specific, a reason that the creature needs to be able to do that. And that's really fun too, because you can then work within a frame and a structure to do something neat and cool and make it your own. But what really inspires me is when I'm giving total carte blanche to do what I think is neat and scary and interesting. So, for example, quite a while ago, Adam came to me before I was an employee and was like, hey, we need you to, we need someone to write a new Demodan. We have this article about the ecology of the Demodans, and to go along with the article, we want you to do a brand new Demodan, because, you know, there were only a handful of Demodans that existed, but of course there are lots of other kinds of Demodans. There were not just those three. So I started thinking and looking at what was there, and it's like, okay, what freaks me out? Demodans are very martial, you know, they're very into the Thanatotic Titans being their masters and advancing their schemes. And it's like, you know what really grosses me out are skin tags. Like, for some reason, I was like, I feel like that is the most, like, gross, nasty thing. That if you had an evil flying creature from the abyss coming at you, you know, you've got your, the more martial Demodans and, you know, the ones that were already there. But it's like, I'm going to make one that's, like, a stringy Demodan. And the original name was something else. And Adam, like, I expect, like, half the time whenever I would, like, pitch a thing to Adam, I would expect him to be like, oh my gosh, that's so stupid. But he always would come back and say, no, do it. So I just take these concepts of things that I find to be gross, disgusting, that would, you know, just be very, like, surreal and very affecting to me as a player if I were to come across it, or that I would really want to play as a GM, and just go from there. And a lot of times I think that can be really good for you as a writer, because then you're thinking of how it will be experienced, as opposed to, like, well, how's it going to look on the page, or what's it going to sound like when you read it?
I remember when your stringy demon dan showed up, because Adam was like, oh, check this out. That man came up with this gross demon dan. I think it was...
She brought us something gross and creepy again.
Yeah. And yeah. It was like, because we had this big discussion in the office, like, we want a new Demodan, and up to this point, the only three that we had were the ones that were from D&D that were introduced back in the Monster Manual 2 and first edition back in, like, 1982 or wherever. And so there hasn't really been new Demodans into the game, as far as there may have been here or there, but this was the first one we were going to build, so we wanted it to be really extra gross and creepy, and we wanted to keep the same sort of naming convention of, like, something gross Demodan, and it had to be something that was like a condition that you could notice when you look at it. So, like, scabby Demodan or something like that would work. But scabby sounds...
I'm trying to think, we
goofy.
Did have
it was
a, we did
it was
have
gristly.
One that we were running. Gristly.
It was the gristly
mm-hmm.
Demodan.
Yeah.
And that's a good one, because that's like having just nasty pieces of gristle hanging off your body. But
it's a very evocative word.
Yeah, I think stringy Demodan works even better, because
it seems benign at first,
and then
until
you think about
you
it,
realize
like,
it
something
like, oh,
that is stringy
oh.
is not
yeah.
going to look pleasant.
Oh yeah, and then they can use, you know, their little skin tags, for lack of a better word, to actually, like, grapple and grab it.
They're
and
all sticky,
with.
Aren't they?
Yeah, they are not sticky.
Oh, okay. No, that's the Tari Demodan.
Yeah, that's right. The Tari Demodan.
Yeah,
but yeah, so, you know, make it look gross, have it be evocative, and then it does a thing that
yep.
is tied to the thing that you're scared of.
And to bring it all full circle, we've got Book of the Damned coming out in September, and we've got tomorrow we'll have an actual dedicated chat about that, a seminar. But did you? I got you to do the Demodan in that one, right? Was that you?
I did
the Squamous one.
Oh, I did do the Squamous Demodan.
So, yes. So we got another one, the Squamous Demodan, and he's like...
He's a frog face.
He's a frog face, and he's like 40 feet tall or something like that.
Frog
and
face was your idea, though.
Maybe.
I think it was.
Okay. He's pretty cool looking. He's CR20. That's
yeah.
the first
he's a
CR20
big,
Demodan.
Nasty
yeah.
dude.
So anyway, yeah, monsters are fun. So, anybody have any monster-related questions, or all good? Right here.
You're talking about liking folklore. What region or nation's folklore have you liked the most or pulled from the most?
A while back, like whenever I first started doing freelance writing, I was really into like Persian folklore, and Wes had gotten me to write the divs that we have in Pathfinder now, and I had just got finished reading a lot of like the Rostam stories and stuff like that, and so the timing was perfect for this. He was like, hey, we have this idea for this new thing, and have you ever heard of divs? I was like, fuck yeah. Yeah, and I know exactly, I just finished reading this. And So yeah, I hit a lot of Persian folklore, but over the years and here recently, I've really been enjoying a lot of American folklore and, you know, Native American stuff, but also like the Americana, like very Appalachian, like, or like the Hodag up in the Midwest is, you know, just it's a logging camp story of, oh, this monster, the Hodag's going to get you. And yeah, I really like a lot of the Americana stuff.
And Pathfinder can.
Yeah. And quite good at
it. Uh-huh. Yeah. Do we have more questions? Or?
Yeah. Right over in the back.
What are the judgment calls when, you know, adapting a monster from a specific fictional source? You know, how do you tell when something's universal enough that you think, yeah, this would work in our game world? Because, okay, so the Deep Ones have a specific historical point of origin with Lovecraft, mm-hmm. but then they sort of osmosed into general nerd culture.
Yeah.
But have you ever, you know, looked at, you know, a fantasy or horror story and thought, oh wow, that is so cool, but no, it would just seem too obvious that we're ripping off Stephen King or whatever?
So we do pull a lot of stuff from public domain stuff, and that Lovecraft's in the public domain. We've got several in Bestiary 6 that are from inspired from stuff in the public domain, like the Horla, and there's a Whisperer from that was inspired by an Algernon Blackwood story, and a couple other things. The Morlocks in Bestiary 1, of course. The tricky thing there is if we are doing something that is inspired by something that's copyrighted and we don't have the actual rights from the copyright holder to do it, we can't actually, you know, call it that. We can certainly be inspired by it, and that's basically a lot of how monster stuff happens that is inspiring. When we do that, we really try to take the inspiration but go with a new route to find something new for it.
Well, yeah, like I saw in a third-party supplement, something that was clearly The Thing, not as in the rock guy from Fantastic Four, but as in the horrifying shapeshifter.
Yeah.
But it didn't look like any kind of blob monster. It looked like this freaking bug thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a case where it's like you get something that is really inspiring. You want to make it your own thing and have it do something that is not obviously just a complete port from something that is a copyright-held intellectual property. And it can be tricky. You want to, you know, pay homage to it. And there's plenty of monsters in our best series that are like obviously inspired by things that we like. Mimic. And you see, like Mimic, we have this creature, and I think it was best series 5 or 4.
4 or 5, yeah.
Yeah, called the Xenopterid, which is basically it's a big bug that kind of can compress its wings in and fold its face just right, so it looks like this creature from this short story called Mimic that got turned into a Guillermo del Toro movie called Mimic. So that's definitely a place we go to for inspiration. And it's also just, if you want to build monsters, one of the things you need to do is just watch monster movies and read monster novels and monster books. And it just goes in your head and kind of stirs itself up into this mess of monstery-ness that you can then pull from. And it's at that point kind of impossible not to be inspired by what you've read, because that's, I guess, the whole point. One of the things actually that you mentioned about folklore monsters I wanted to bring up that's really kind of interesting, and it kind of ties into this, is that there's universal fears. Everybody's afraid of like strangers. Everybody's afraid of the dark. Everybody's afraid of disease and all of that. So you have all these different cultures spread across the world that don't really have much contact with each other, but they all have these same fears. So you always see in culture these monsters pop up, and they're like these archetypes, like the monster that hides in the bushes and calls your name. The monster, you know, that comes in the middle of the night and steals away your baby. All of these different monster archetypes are repetitive, and they come up again and again and again. And from the purposes of building a bestiary, you know, we always want new monsters to fill those pages so that we can make a book that we can sell and make money and then make more monster books and continue the cycle. Those folklore stories are a great place to go for inspiration, but you want to, in the same way you want to like vary it when you're being inspired by like a movie or something like that, you don't want to reprint the same monster over and over and over again, even though it's like this, the Maori version of it is maybe very different from the Chinese version, which is very different from the Visigoth version or all this stuff. They're all kind of the same monster, but you want to have different things to them. So. Yeah.
Since you mentioned archetypical things about monsters and monsters that prey upon the fears of individuals, of cultures, of people in general, do you want to talk a little bit about Sakiels?
Oh.
because Adam is the architect of your fears and nightmares.
Yeah, so one of our newest groups of outsiders is the Suckheels, and they're all about fear and different types of fears. So each one of them has their own, you know, their own shtick, and one of them is like, you know, fear of isolation, fear of failed relationships, fear of invasive body, you know, like fear of needles and stuff like that. And it's fun coming up with those that are in that category, because you just got to think about it. It's like, oh, what really freaks people out? What scares people? You know, and fear of the dark is, that's one. I haven't done that yet, but I need to do a fear of the dark. And I didn't because I couldn't figure out how I wanted the mechanics to work.
It's a case there where it's like the darkness rules are, they're in the game and they work, but they're really frustrating. You know, it's hard to describe what you mm-hmm. can't see.
I'm going to go back to something else with the folklore thing. You can also take something that's from certain folklore and switch it up a little bit. Like, for example, leshies come from Slavic folklore. But what we did with leshies is completely different from, you know, adorable little plant critters are not the same as, like, you know, the woodland protector that the leshy was in Slavic folklore.
Yeah, and we've messed with that a little bit, and there will be a creature coming out in volume number 5 of Iron Fang Invasion that will look a lot like a leshy if all you do is look at the art.
Nice.
Maybe not so nice.
Excellent. So, the question, yeah.
So, thank you guys for templates, because they're really fun to do to your metagaming players. They'll be like, this always works on this kind of monster, but I'm just like, and Shadow Loons are fun. So, what have been some of your favorite templates to work on?
To work with.
Work with, work on.
Or create, okay. Cool.
We actually, Wizards of the Coast was the original source that came up with templates in 3rd edition back in when they relaunched D&D as 3rd edition. And it was one of these new, just kind of eye-opening elements of, like, this is something that GMs have always kind of done, like in games and all that, like mess with monsters. Like, this is an orc, but he's got blue skin and he spits acid and stuff like that. And having it quantified in the game as a set of rules that you can use to apply to monsters is huge. It's one of the two great innovations, I think, that Wizards of the Coast did with D&D. I think the other one was the idea of the prestige class and how multi-classing works. Templates were, for a point, they were so popular that everybody was using them. It's like half dragon, everything is a half dragon, and they kind of got overwhelming. So, especially working on Dungeon Magazine, I'd see adventure proposals come in nonstop. It's like, I have this great idea for an adventure, it's a half dragon. It's like, no, your idea is not great. I got a stack of 60 of them here that I don't like.
They're all half dragons.
But templates are still cool. I think myself, one of my favorite templates that we've worked on and developed and all that is the ghost. And the reason I like that template is because this is a template that when it first came out, it was basically, this is just something that is a incorporeal thing that is like what it was before, but now it can make you age faster. But with Bestiary, Bestiary 1, when I was developing the ghost template, I wanted to basically, because every ghost story you read is different. The ghost is there for a specific reason, it has a specific history, and its powers are tied to why it died and why it's there. And being able to set it up so that the ghost template is not only something where you get like a list of powers you can give it as they get more powerful, built into the template is basically something that says, you're the GM, you're making this ghost, make sure it has a power you made up for it for the spot. So whenever we make a new template, a new ghost in a game, we can make up new powers, and it just continues to increase the number of options for ghosts, and I think ghosts are my favorite.
So I really like templates as an adventure writer and as a GM, because they, like you said, they allow you to sort of bolt on something to a creature that the players all think that they know about, especially at lower levels. They're like, oh, you know, it's a rat swarm, I know what rat swarms are. Oh, you know, it's a goblin, I know what a goblin does. It's an orc, I know what an orc does. But the templates, and especially some of the simple templates that we have in the back of the first bestiary, really let you mess with players and sort of turn some of those assumptions on their head. And a really good example of that is we had a module that came out last year that's called Gallows of Madness, that is a first level sort of introductory type of module that has three self-contained or an arc of adventures in it And it's meant to be core, so it's meant to help introduce people to GMing, introduce people to playing. And so we had to make everything core content or reprint the stuff or just do new stat blocks for creatures from other best series other than the first best series. And one of the challenges that James sort of came to me when, you know, we talked about outlining this was, you know, this has got to be more than just like your boring goblin first level adventures. It's got to be like something interesting to it. And the way that we solved that problem was that we used the Fiendish template for a lot of the creatures, especially in the first adventure. And it tied into the theme of the story in which they're, you know, there was a demon that was connected to the whole thing. I don't want to give a lot of spoilers, but there's a reason that a lot of these archetypical first level monsters have the Fiendish template. And a lot of, you know, players, that was my way of sort of throwing something at the veterans who are playing this game and making them figure out where it's coming from, because it's a totally new sort of made up thing as to why this template is applied. But there's a little bit of investigation involved in what would normally just be, well, first level introductory module for some of the folks that are more used to the game. So for me, that simple template, which is super tiny, it's like this big on the page, was able to sort of transform a whole module. And that's just really useful.
You can actually just do that even in game, even go even more simple, like use the stats for the creature just as they are in the book. And then just change the description. So like I was mentioning this yesterday in another seminar, whatever, a couple days ago, have a wyvern swoop down and attack the party, but don't tell the party that it's a wyvern. Don't describe it as a wyvern. Describe it as, this is a big sort of, looks like a horse, but it's got fly wings and a snake for a tail. And it's, when it swoops down, it just starts like shrieking like a newborn baby. And then you go with the fight, just use the wyvern statistics, you know, with the snake tail as its poison stinger and its like weird horse mouth as its bite attack and all of that. And the player characters, the players are going to be like, what is this thing? It's shrieking like a baby in a sense. Is it shrieking from its tail
and
mouth?
They're terrified, right?
Yeah. They don't know what it is. Mouth. And you don't even have to go that far. You can just say this wyvern swoops down, but it doesn't have any eyes, and it's got an eye inside of its mouth, so it can see outside of its mouth. And that doesn't change its stats at all, but the player character is like, why does this wyvern have like a mouth eye?
The templates that I really enjoy, the simple templates in Monster Codex, the class templates.
Oh, the class, yeah.
Such a welcome thing, because a lot of times you have a monster, like let's say you've got a, you know, 14th level adventure and you take, you know, a CR 13 monster and you want to, you know, okay, this should be a sorcerer of some sort, and you add two whole levels of sorcerer, and it's like, oh well, yeah, I can cast that first level spell, and it kind of diminishes the impact of what that monster is. But with those simple class templates, it gives you the you know, a roundabout where it's still high level, so you know, you've got a thing that it only adds like +2 to the CR, but it has the full suite of spell casting that you don't have to wiggle as if you were just putting an actual class onto it.
It's always been like a weird point of disconnect to me. Like if you have a Balor demon, it's a CR20 demon, it's really tough, and you give it one level of fighter, it turns into a CR21 creature. So it's a little bit tougher. And the fighter stuff stacks really well with the Balor's powers because you can give it more hit points and all of that. But telling the party that you're fighting a Balor fighter, that's pretty frightening. Telling them that they're fighting a Balor first level fighter is like,
oh.
So he's got like 5 hit points and has a short sword? Is that what's going
baby
on?
Baby Balor.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird to apply class levels to creatures that are powerful because it's got that weird disconnect. And these templates dodge that.
Yeah, like in, you know, using the Balor as an example, you can't have a 20th level fighter Balor because we don't have...
The rules don't go that way.
We don't have rules for that. So...
No.
Is there ever plans to flesh out those class templates with all of the newer classes?
I would like to. I don't know where we would do it. So maybe sometime. A bestiary would be an interesting, I mean, that would make sense to put it there, but the problem with the bestiary is that every page we use to add in that type of back matter stuff is one new monster list we've done. So it's a kind of a give and take.
When you swap out kind of the monster, like you were talking about the wyvern, which is a common example,
yeah,
just describe it differently. You know, the first thing the players are going to do is knowledge check. So do you come up with some random name to say, you know, because otherwise if you go, well, it's a wyvern, then steals all that.
If you do come up with, you should have a reason for why the wyvern is looking in a weird sort of way. I mean, whether it's like it's been drinking from a magic pool that has mutated it, or it's been like playing in radiation or something like that. There's you should always have as the GM a backstory for that. And if you don't, you probably shouldn't do it. But another thing to do that is really helpful is listen to the players. Sometimes their ideas are great, and you could say something along the lines of like, yeah, you don't know. It's a weird that it has an eye mouth and a horse tail or whatever, or a snake tail. Make a knowledge arcane check or whatever you want to do. Have them and they roll it. Whatever they roll, you say, oh, not quite. You're not sure. You heard weird rumors. And if you're running an adventure, you know you want them to go to the wizard tower. You might say something like, you heard rumors that this wizard in the nearby tower is doing stuff. So, or then even turn it on themselves and say, I don't know, you've... What do you think maybe is going on? You've seen creatures with snake tails like this before. So kind of listen to the players. They'll start spouting theories on their own without even asking. And if they do say something like, oh, this is the sixth time we've seen a monster with an eye in its mouth. Remember that statue we encountered seven sessions ago? And you may have just thrown that in as just a bit of flavor. And then you're like, oh, yeah. No, I've totally planned that. Makes it look like you're a really good GM.
Back. To help you out over here, Roji is game to release a book of class templates for the other classes that are available.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Check out the third-party publishers. And Rogue Genius Games, of course, is Owen and Stevens. So even though it's a third-party publisher, had we done it, it would probably have looked pretty much the same way anyway. Yeah. So yeah, I would definitely check out Rogue Genius Games. Does all of that stuff, and that's really one of the strengths of the OGL open gaming movement is we can't do everything. No one company can do everything. But when you have, I was talking to Jason Nelson, and he's I guess put out 140 books this year, which is insane.
Yep.
For a guy that I used to game with and. Yeah, so there's a lot of options out there that are really pretty good stuff. Or questions?
Have you ever come across a monster and just decided, like, this isn't going to work, or it's too horrifying, or it's too complicated? Like, how often do you come up with ideas
that
are just kind of infeasible?
Not so much, I don't think, too complicated. That's something you can do with anything. And when you're designing rules, you can overcomplicate it. And that's just part of being a rules designer, is knowing when to stop. But there's a lot of, I mean, there's a huge amount of monsters from folklore that delve into territories that are just not appropriate for an RPG. Like monster, there's a fear of rape, for example, is something that is in every culture. And there's a lot of monsters out there that build off of that. And, you know, the succubus and the incubus are examples of that. Vampires.
There's a lot of, especially in, like, Slavic folklore, there's a ton of things about, like, dead babies that weren't baptized.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no.
Yeah, it's just not really appropriate.
Don't want to use that.
But the monster itself, like, vampires are really cool. So you can do all sorts of vampire stuff without going into, like, certain sections. The kappa is a great example. This is this weird little turtle guy that lives in rivers, and he's got a bowl for his head, and he's filled with water, and you can knock him down, and if his water spills out, he's like, I have lost my powers. He's like a little gremlin thing. And there's this element from Japanese folklore that what they do is they grab young boys and they eat this magic ball of power outside of their anus. And that's part of the place that kappas get their strength and stuff like that. And that's like, that's Japanese folklore. And it's just not appropriate to put that into, you know, a role-playing game about this little weird turtle man. So a lot of cases we'll stumble across those those elements, and we just don't include them because they're just not appropriate for the game. I mean, if you are at your table and you want to draw in more like real-world mythologies and stuff like that, absolutely, it's your table. Make sure that you have the consent of your party and your players that everybody's on the same page. You don't want to drive off your players because you creeped them out or something like that. Yeah.
When you're driving from those like real worlds, mythologies, and folklore things, how much do you consider the line between
dropping those stories and like appropriating my what might be like, you know, pretty important cultural things. Taking those and you're making them and be like taking away those harsher elements.
Yeah.
How do you kind of deal with that?
That's also a really tricky thing. That's why we don't do things. There's a lot of times there could be, I don't know. I mean, that's something really like with Native American history and folklore that is, that's been so often misrepresented and just done so poorly in just crass ways that it's gross. And we try not to do that. And one of the ways, one of the big ways we do that is we talk amongst each other. Make sure that we're not crossing those lines, that what we're doing pays respect to the culture that we're taking it from. Often we will reach out to freelancers and friends, and it's just people who we know are from that culture, and make sure that we're not stepping on toes, or we'll go to actual freelancers who are from that tradition.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, the main thing is just, and this changes from creature to creature and, you know, culture to culture, but mainly it's just like, try to be as faithful and respectful as possible in your design.
Yeah, I think these two have really hit the nail on the head here, that the main thing is about respect, and it's about understanding the source material and trying as much as we can to look at the place that piece of folklore has in the culture, to look at the place in the history of where it is coming from, and not doing something like taking, you know, a sacred animal and putting it as a CR2 creature in Pathfinder that you can kill when it is, you know, a deity in a culture of another area, and, you know, trying to avoid big things like that as much as we can, asking each other, running ideas beyond, you know, other people who have experiences outside of us, and, you know, getting sensitivity readers, and basically just doing everything that we can to respect cultures and to respect especially, like, people who are still living cultures that are still living cultures, and just not being a jerk.
Yeah, and despite all of that, care and everything, we have in the past crossed over that line and done
perfect
stuff that's bad before. And at that point, it's really important for us to own up to our mistakes, to admit that, hey, we screwed up.
Yeah.
Let's talk, figure out how to fix it. And then we take steps to fix it. We'll issue erratas or we'll do whatever it needs to take to fix it.
Yeah, we never want to do harm to anybody. And, you know, we're not perfect. And when somebody gets pointed out
characters
to us, we don't want to deal harm to actual people. Characters. Yeah. Characters are on their own.
Yeah.
But yeah, we try to be open about that.
Just along that line, it's one of the reasons I appreciate the investigators, the back matter. I appreciate the little notes that say, oh, this comes from this culture. Mm-hmm. You know, here's how it's represented in mythology. And often you say how you've changed or softened it. And as someone who, you know, in part of the fan community, blogs about it, my readers definitely are far more excited to see their culture included on average than they are upset.
Yeah.
The blood hag, I don't know how to say it, starts with an S.
Sukhyan?
I had a reader ecstatic, and she's like, it's my culture is Caribbean, I'm so excited to see it here. Wish it wasn't a monster, but you know, I want to see my culture represented also positively, but I'm glad my monster isn't there.
Yeah.
Also, for all of you in here, if you really like monsters, you need to follow Patchen's blog, The Daily Bestiary. It's awesome.
Cool.
Unnecessary.
Done anyway.
It's recorded now.
Yep.
So.
More questions? Yeah.
Have you ever received any monster art that's just made you go, oh my god, no?
Yes.
Yeah.
All the time, actually.
Like, as in, we can't do anything with this monster, or as in, this is rad.
Sickens you, horrifies you, cannot use. Any amusing stories to that end?
When I was like 10 years old, my grandmother gave me a copy of Cujo and said, you should check this guy out. And I read Pet Sematary next year, and then a couple years later, it's like, you should read Clive Barker, he's even better. And so, I've been neck deep in the grisly, edgy horror phenomenon for 40 years almost now. And I do still see things that are generally like, we can't, that's too much for me, that's over the top. It's generally not in the venue of like art that we get in. It's more like this, like an obscure French horror movie that's like, what? No, thank you. But part of that is, I think I might be, I mean, I know that there's certainly monsters and imagery and stuff that goes too far, and I tend to get a bit you know, overly, I don't, I'm not protective, but I like self-censoring, I guess, when it comes to that, except when I've been deliberately had that spigot turned on, like we back when we were working on the Book of Vile Darkness for Wizard of the Coast, and we did the special sealed section for Dragon and Dungeon magazine. It was like they came to me and said, "James, we want you to write an adventure for this. Just go crazy." And there's some stuff in there that is pretty grim and pretty dark. But we certainly, I mean, any examples of
things? I haven't. In regards to art, because he was talking of art, this isn't something that we just, you know, couldn't use or didn't use, but I've done a couple of times where I've been given a picture, and it's like, make stats for this thing.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a ton of fun. One of the ones that I did for Pathfinder was the Storm Ghost during Reign of Winter. Raven Mamura was the artist, and he just made something. And, like, we didn't even give him, I think all we said was something like, it needs to be something that's wintry. And so he gave us this weird four-legged thing with the, and I just was like, okay, how can this be a monster? And just start, it's like, okay, well, it's got these weird things, like eyes that ring its head, so it's got all-around vision. And just building from the art is a ton of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really inspiring. I mean, even if you're just working on normal creatures, like when we first had Wayne do the cover for Burnt Offerings, and those goblins came in, it's like, these goblins obviously enjoy being goblins, so it's inspiring working with art that way.
We occasionally have art that does come in that touches on what you said that other certain staff members might find to be a little too much, and there has been more than one time where something will be over in editing and there will be a post-it note over the art because the editor just cannot look at that piece of art. So there's, and a lot of times it's just like, oh, this personally really bothers me because I really have an issue with, you know, this type of thing, and I just don't want to stare at it for 8 hours every day. But yeah, absolutely. There's sometimes things that...
It's more the nudity is what happens in art a lot, where artists will... We use a lot of artists from beyond America, like all over the world, where the nudity element is not nearly as a big of a deal. And it creeps into like turnovers and stuff like that now and then. And we can't publish any of that in Pathfinder because it's just not what we do. And so that's an element where it's like, well, this is great, but that guy needs to wear pants or something.
So just for clarification, the Vile Darkness adventure you're talking about, that was Porphyry House, is that right?
Yeah, Porphyry House Horrors.
So yeah, that was excellent. Okay. And you were talking about Clive Barker, and I do believe I've seen a lot of that inspiration, like Zaku from a lot of your stuff in Galarian. Is that accurate?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. I love Clive Barker.
Clive Barker is a lot of... So the thing with Clive Barker is he just exploded onto the scene in the mid-80s, which is when D&D was really, really exploding as well. So everybody that was playing D&D was into Clive Barker, so it's...
Yeah. We have one more question.
We got one.
Can you talk about a kind of feat selection, especially with higher level monsters? At what point do you balance between, okay, this is a stat boosting feat because then it's a little less to deal with as a GM versus, you know, feats that actually let the monster to make different choices?
I tend to not select feats that are overly complicated for monsters just for the whole sake of it helps GMs run things, and which also a GM can, you know, get rid of dodge and put in something more complicated on the fly if they really want to. But yeah, I try to keep it really simple, and a lot of times a lot of feat selection goes to bump their numbers to where they're supposed to be. Like, oh man, this reflex save is terrible. All right, lightning reflexes, it's not exciting, but it gets those numbers where they need to be.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we design monsters, we basically use that table 1-1 in the bestiary to basically say, we know it's a CR12 monster, so that means it's all of these values need to be in line here. We can have one of them be above expectation by a little bit because that gives that monster a focus. But some feats are great for doing that. You can manipulate all those numbers by just basically changing their stats, their ability scores, and their hit die. But sometimes you can't really do that at all because it makes all those other numbers go thrown out of whack, at which point you can throw in lightning reflexes or improved initiative or something like that to basically fix things. there's a couple of feats like toughness and improved natural armor and improved natural attack that are cool, but I don't like giving them to monsters at all because you can arbitrarily decide
how much natural armor.
Yeah, how much natural armor.
You can just change that.
Yeah, you just artificially change that. If the monster needs 5 more points of armor, just give it 5 points of natural armor. You don't have to give it a feat. And that leaves that feat aside. So if somebody wants to come along later and build a monster that's a little tougher, they can throw that feat on there to make it better. But I agree absolutely with Adam. When I build monsters, I try to only use feats from the core rulebook because that helps to generate system mastery. That you know those feats, you don't have to read 7 or 8 books to figure out how this monster works. And
yeah, you're already in a bestiary, and then you have to reference Ultimate Magic to figure out what this monster does. And
that's too much. I think generally speaking, when we want monsters to be able to do cool things, we tend to just put them in supernatural or spell-like abilities as a unique thing that monster can do. And so that sort of like helps guide the GM to look at what the action economy is like for what that monster can do instead of just like, okay, well, we're going to give it, you know, awesome blow, and we're going to give it grab, and we're going to give it pull, and we're going to give it swallow hold and all that stuff. One, really, of those types of things or a chain of those things is cool, but beyond that, like, giving it special abilities that, you know, make it fun to play with as the GM and make it scary for the players, I think is better monster design in general.
Yeah, it's important to remember that the monster is going to be on screen for maybe 3 or 4 combat rounds on average, and then he's gone. And so if you give a monster more than three or four things to do, chances are he's not going to be able to do most of that stuff anyway, so that's overly complicated. You do want to make the monster variable enough, especially if it's like a mastermind type creature. You want to have enough variety so that in encounter 1 it's doing this, in encounter 2 it's doing this, and so forth and so on. But really, all of the feats and the spells and all of those options that we publish in our other hardcover books, those are really, really aimed at player characters, because you want the player characters, they're on every scene. You want them to be as super unique as possible, and the more options you give them, the easier it is to make them unique. When you're building a monster, like you were saying, Amanda, you can just decide that this thing has 25 eyes and one of them can see through time. You don't have to give it the see through time fee, which we haven't published yet, I don't think.
No.
Spoilers, James.
Not yet.
All right. What we got? Oh, I got plenty of time.
Yeah.
Is there a difference when you're creating something that's purely like a bestiary monster versus maybe working for an AP where it's like, you know, we need like Bar's Life Rune to have like a stat block? Is it different when it's more of a character encounter of an NPC versus just something weird and monstrous?
It can be. I mean, for Bar's Life Rune, since he's a dude, we built him like a player character. So in that case, since he's the main villain for an entire adventure path, we do want him to be unique and hyper specialized in whatever ways he's doing his thing. And in that case, we do go in and try to find the exact right feat and so forth to make it work. We still try to keep it as minimal as possible, so you don't have to have 5 books open to run them. But at the same point, it's also he's an NPC, but he's also a creation. So you can just arbitrarily give him like a weird power and say that he's got this ability, or he's got his point buy was built with 25 point buy because he was destined for greatness, or all sorts of that type of stuff. Then you treat it just like a monster. As long as his CR score is putting him on that line in table 1-1, you're in pretty much the right place.
Yeah, I think an easy trick a lot of us do is we just give them PC wealth, which will just make them that equal CR to their role.
Yeah.
And give them more stuff to play with. Do we have any other questions?
Yeah.
Unique mechanics, you know, ranging from, you know, things Elder Worms can do to everybody's favorite Pokemon blood manipulation. So, like, what are your favorites and what are the unique challenges of, you know, CR balance and stuff when you're dealing with those?
Pokemon, the luck thing is pretty cool.
I'm totally blanking on any specific examples right now.
The weird thing with Pugwumpies is I came up with them for my homebrew game, and they were like these little sort of Arctic lemur short little pirates. And so they were like these guys this tall, and they could use their like, they could like climb around in the rigging, so they're like kind of monkey lemur type little critters, and they had all this piracy type stuff and nautical themes and all that. That was my original idea for Pugwalking, and I basically turned that over to Eric, and he's like, no, dude, this is what they should do. He's like, yeah, you're right. They're luck eaters.
It made me think of, I just thought of like a mechanic thing that I did recently with one of the Suck Heels, the one that's all about fear of isolation. It has this ability where if you fail your save, everyone that's an ally to you no longer sees you, and you're treated as incorporeal, so they can't even touch you and bump into you in combat, and you cannot see any of your allies. So it's like you're, all of a sudden, you're fighting, you know, four of you are fighting this monster, and all of a sudden, you are fighting this monster, and you don't have any help.
That's cool.
That was a lot of fun.
Sometimes unique abilities are the ways that your players identify what kind of creature that they're fighting, right? If they see, you know, a giant tongue come out from an undead creature, it's just like, oh, okay, well, it's this, and so it's going to have all these abilities. Sometimes it's fun to make unique stat blocks of those types of creatures, and alternate stat blocks and give them something else that will surprise the players. It might be as easy as like swapping out the feats, or you know, say like, I don't know, it's an Aranese devil, and so like, but instead of you know, the bow, that she's got a whip or something, and so there's, it makes the players sort of be like, oh, what else could this thing do? And now we don't know anything about the creature. We rolled crappy, you know, in our knowledge planes to figure out what it does, and so it makes the encounter fun and interesting. And you can, you know, either change it, or you can say, well, this creature, you know, doesn't have, you know, the normal DR, doesn't have the normal immunities, and sort of just watch your players squirm a little bit.
There's a fair amount, just because I worked on Bestiary 6 earlier in the year. There's a lot of stuff in there that has, like, some really cool, crazy power stuff. Because there's a lot of high CR creatures in there. Like, the Avatar of Yogg-Sothoth has basically the ability, since he can create this avatar Talo Atamur out of nothingness, and every second, in every microsecond this avatar exists, it's a different avatar. So if you kill him, he can just make another one show up. And he usually won't do that to you, because he's like, well, if you kill that one, maybe you deserve to live for 25-30 minutes or something like that. So so yeah, it's fun coming up with these just really unusual rules-breaking encounters that turn things on their head and make the player characters have to think and deal with things in a different way. The Pugwampi is a great example, because they're not that scary. They're not that tough. They've got like 2 hit points, but the fact that they cause this luck, you have to roll twice when you roll your checks twice around them and all of that, it just made them infamous. People just hate them, and they're something you could throw into a game where it's like, well, you're 7th level, and there's 5 hill giants charging you, and there's a Pugwampi sitting up on the balcony, like, doing nothing. And the player characters will ignore the hill giants, go after the Pugwampi, and the hill giants are meanwhile just wailing on him, and it's like, dude, leave the Pugwampi alone. He's messing with the hill giants just as much.
Oh, it looks like back there.
Do you have a monster yet, each of you, that you are ready or want to get a beast at?
Ooh, let's see. I mean, obviously, yes. There's always monsters that I would like to get more of them in there. A lot, yeah. I can't think of one off the top of my head. Oh, man. Mm. Yes. I know there is. There's got to be something.
Yes, no question.
It is, yes. Yes, absolutely. There's always new monsters, I guess, is what I'm saying.
In the vein of B7, if you want to take the quest, mm-hmm. I love the concept of shocker lizards. Not necessarily that they do electricity, but that cooperative measure that one alone mm-hmm. is not dangerous. 5 of them together is freaking dangerous.
Check out the Wild Hunt. The Wild Hunt in Bestiary 6 has this ability. I forget exactly how it works, but there's wild, like the monarchs and the horses and the archers and the scouts and the hounds, all of these things, they have an ability that grants other Wild Hunt creatures a power. And so if you've got a full-on Wild Hunt with one of everything, they're a lot more powerful than they are alone, because the dogs might grant everything blind sense, and the horses might increase everyone's speed and all that stuff. So when you're encountering the Wild Hunt, if you focus on all of, you know, the archers, you can take them down, and then the rest of the Wild Hunt maybe doesn't have extra attacks with arrows or however it works. So it works along like that. So that's definitely something that we enjoy doing, like monsters that work with each other in a synergistic sort of way.
I've been shocked at lizards quite a few times.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Yeah, it's cool.
Instead of, you know, monsters you want to put in, lice in V6 were clearly a problem-solving exercise, like, let's make oozes more interesting, let's make them intelligent, see what happens. Mm-hmm. So are there problems you'd like to solve or categories you'd like to play with that you're excited to play with in future Vesteria and future products?
I would like to continue playing with, I mean, blights solve more than just that we want to have like high CR oozes that are intelligent stuff. They also solve the problem of we need high CR monsters that are medium sized. Hmm. So many monsters that are above like CR 10 are huge or larger that it's hard to have them on the battlefield with player characters that are 5 foot square. So that's something that I've recently been doing a lot of when I'm doing high CR monsters is try to skew them toward medium-sized creatures.
And it's hard to write and develop adventures as well when you're trying to write a 15th level adventure and your only options are outsiders or dragons, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, this adventure has nothing to do with outsiders and dragons. Okay, I guess I'm putting class levels on some of these lower level creatures. So yeah, we're kind of helping ourselves a little bit with that
One of the things I did preparing for Bestiary 6 is I went through Bestiaries 1 through 5 and took every monster and every type and made this crazy, like, chart in Excel to figure out what all the CR spreads for everything were. And it's like, turns out if you go through Bestiaries 1 through 5 and you want to have a monstrous humanoid, once you hit CR 12, I think it is, the only options above that are like three different Thryae, which are these kind of bee people. And they're cool, but they're super specific. You don't have, if you have Thryae, you have lots of Thryae, but if you don't have Thryae, you can't use any of them because they're such this weird communal sort of hive creature. So that was a case where in Bestiary 6, I wanted to have all sorts of new monstrous humanoids above CR 10. So we've got things like the Soglav, which is the Serbian monster that has iron teeth and eat bones. We've got Krampus, CR 20 monstrous humanoid.
Excited about that one.
Krampus is pretty awesome.
Krampus is pretty awesome.
Krampus, that's a great example of like weird abilities. Krampus, what he can do is if he grabs you and he stuffs you into his gross Krampus bag, you turn into a kid. And that means you have a lot of penalties and are easy to keep caught up and carried off to wherever Krampus carries kids off to, which is, you don't want that to happen.
You don't want to know. Mm. I think we have maybe time for one more.
What do we got here? Yeah, one or two if they're short. Questions. Or one. Come on. It's got to be one.
More plans for troops?
So we'll get to you in a second. Troops, one of the things I've been trying to get troops into a bestiary since we first came up with Bestiary 4, and it was sort of a weird, there was this perception that the troop is a template, and it's not. It's the same type of creature type as like a swarm, and I was trying to convince other people around who didn't work on adventures, like we all were on the same page that this is a monster type, it should be in the bestiary, and it was weirdly difficult to get them into the book because it's like, bestiary should be a place where you're fighting like one-eyed metal-toothed creatures that eat bones. You shouldn't fight like a bunch of poachers or a group of like city guards or a band of hobos. But it's still something that we needed to get in the book. Every time we used a troop in an adventure path, we'd have to reprint a page of content.
Yep.
So getting them into Bestiary 6 was basically one of the top three things I wanted to do in that book. The others was get like a bunch of high CR things in there and then dinosaurs. But so now that we've got troops in hardcover and the troop dynamic, all the rules are going to be on the SRD, we can create new troops a lot easier now, not just in Bestiary 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 20, but in adventure paths and campaign setting books, we can go forward from there with these. And then the last question.
All right, so guilty pleasure monsters, some of the weirder ones that you just have a soft spot for. In particular?
It's hard to say because...
Like the Misfit Monsters?
I guess Misfit Monsters. If we were to each pick, I know what yours is.
Yep.
I ended up with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be your choice.
Yeah.
But you can announce it if you want.
I'm known for being a champion of the flump.
And good aberrations in general.
Yeah. Yeah, good aberrations is something I've definitely like challenged a few freelancers before to like pitch me some good ideas for. Because it's really difficult to have something that is completely aberrant, but kind and wants everyone to be happy.
Just because it looks weird doesn't mean it's mean.
Right.
Mine is probably the Frog Hemoth, which I just love Frog Hemoths. The name is goofy. The monster kind of silly looking, but no, I think it's scary. It's something like, yeah.
Man, he kind of stole mine because...
You could go with Mabogo. That's like...
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. I'm just going to copy you and say Frog Hemoth.
Those are awesome.
We have art of a deflated Frog Hemoth in Inner Sea Fates. You haven't seen it? It's in the Glonder section.
Yeah. There's mosquito.
The aspect of Glonder is like draining a Frog Hemoth, and the Frog Hemoth looks tiny because Glonder is a huge mosquito.
Nice.
And I also put one into my adventure. It's coming out next month.
Awesome.
Actually, two.
Frog Hemoth. Cool. Well, thank you, everybody.
Yep.
Good. Have it all. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.